Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
I'm Joe Martin.
And I'm Adam Voley. We're here to ask each other one very simple question about Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Joe?
I was entertained, surprisingly so. I have a long list of comments and one very big critique of the film, but the overall effect is that I was entertained. I enjoyed myself in the theater yesterday. I enjoyed the story, in spite of what I thought were its defects. I wouldn't say I was necessarily on the edge of my seat, but I think at times I was very close to being on the edge of my seat, and I had a lot of fun. So overall, I'm going to give this movie a thumbs up.
Well, I'll be. Okay. Yes, God help me. I, too, was entertained, which I wasn't honestly expecting. I had some hope because it's Rian Johnson, who is one of the new gods. But it's the best movie since the original trilogy, I think. Everything about it is fantastically well done. Any problems I have with it are not really in terms of execution. So yeah, dig a little deeper, Joe. What did you love about it?
What I loved about it was just the sense of cohesiveness in a well-written story. I mean, we've both discussed Rogue One and The Force Awakens, and Rogue One, as we discussed, had some fairly significant flaws, and The Force Awakens suffered from essentially just being a retelling of movies that we'd already seen. This was a movie that restored my faith in the franchise a little bit, and that it was its own thing. It had a number of callbacks to previous films, but they were just that. They were callbacks. They weren't whole-scale remakes. And it told its own story in its own way, using the characters that it had, and it actually felt like a good story in the Star Wars universe. And honestly, I'd been losing a little bit of faith that we would actually get that from the new management of Star Wars, and it's good to see that there might be a future for this franchise after all, at least as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, no, that's about right. You know, I mean, what's so refreshing is that, as you say, The Force Awakens, it not only hewed very closely to a point-by-point retelling of A New Hope, but it was about Star Wars. And so the difference here is that this movie not only took a lot of the stock elements, which you would expect from Star Wars films, but it took them and it rearranged them. And it did so in order to make a point. It's a movie about something. There are multiple themes here. You know, Bestow My Heart.
There are multiple characters with actual legitimate story arcs.
And yes, almost all of them have arcs. and it's also a beautiful film. You know, I mean, not that you can say anything bad about The Force Awakens in those terms, but I remember first going back to find out the director's name after noticing that a couple of episodes of Breaking Bad were just really beautiful. And seeing that those episodes were inevitably done by Rian Johnson. And in this, so there are just, you know, a couple of moments here, for example, the Salt Planet, when you're just struck by the gorgeous colors, or the throne room, if you would. So no, top to bottom, obviously this is still a movie that was created by an executive committee in Disney's headquarters. But Rian Johnson has managed to pull a good film out of that. And all power to him.
He did. And one, I'll go ahead and say something about the Salt Planet. That was one of the moments when I decided I actually really did truly like this movie. Because it was a callback to the Empire landing on Hoth and the entire snow battles that we had in Hoth with the snow speeders. And
yes,
you get a look at the snow planet And I legitimately thought it was a cold planet the first couple of scenes we had, because it has that look. It's white, it's desolate. There's a big cavernous hangar that everybody's hanging out in, and you're like, oh, okay, this is Hoth 2.0.
They saved it for the end rather than the beginning. How clever.
Right? How clever. But otherwise, we're gonna end at Hoth, and it's going to kind of be a mirror image. And then the character steps out, and the ground is red underneath his feet. And my thought is, okay, he stepped on something sharp. He's bleeding as he walks out to confront the oncoming Imperial walkers. And then the character touches it, licks it, and says, it's salty. And that's when you realize it's an entire planet of salt, and it's red underneath. And that's just, it's awesome, because he, in a way, it feels like he knew we would be expecting, after The Force Awakens, that we would be expecting a whole-scale ripoff of a previous sequence. And so he took that and ran with it, and then flipped it on its head. It's like, okay, I like that sense of surprise. I like that sense of playfulness. That was the point I decided this movie really worked for me.
I mean, it's funny that that's toward the end, because, it's what Rian Johnson has done here is he took the remit he played off of it. You know, the fact that The Force Awakens was such a carbon copy of A New Hope is actually something The Last Jedi kind of uses in judo style, you know, taking all those expectations that have been not only established by the first six movies, but really reinforced by the seventh. And again and again, turning it into a wrong footing. I mean, one of the big themes of the whole story is dashed expectations, disappointment. And so you've got Snoke getting cut in the half in what should be, a retelling of the Return of the Jedi throne room part. You've got Luke tossing the lightsaber over his shoulder, time after time. And it's a lot of fun.
And I did like how this movie in certain scenes seemed to pick up almost immediately where The Force Awakens left off. The first scene we get of Rey and Luke on the island is pretty much immediately after we left them in The Force Awakens. Rey mm-hmm. walking up to Luke, Master Luke, handing him the lightsaber, him looking at it, and you're expecting some kind of, I don't know, profound comment, some kind of a welcome, some kind of a, oh, this is my old lightsaber, something. And to have Luke just kind of stare at it for a couple of seconds and then dismissively toss it over his shoulder as something that had no value to him whatsoever. You're right, wrong-footing the audience and subverting expectations in just an absolutely wonderful way.
It even plays into the fact that everyone thought that extended stare at the end of The Force Awakens was kind of weird.
Right.
Everyone thought that went on for about 10 seconds too long. So you were expecting something great at the end of that. It's build up. And yes. So using that as undercutting that was great fun. And of course, all of this, this wrong footing plays into a strong theme, you know, the breaking, the dashed expectations and then breaking free of the past. I think that's really smart. And the weird, I'm scrambled at the idea that this whole movie had a point, but, and this is actually, I think, a source of contention from what I've seen on Twitter and the rest a little bit, because, The Force Awakens raised questions that this film not only doesn't have an interest in really answering, but very pointedly declares don't matter.
This is actually one of the notes I'd written on page one, is that J.J. Abrams' style is the colossal tease. It seems like every one of his movies or TV shows are built around throwing out a bunch of stuff and never really answering it. And The Force Awakens felt like classic J.J. Abrams in that style. We get Snoke, and when we see him in The Force Awakens, he's this massive holographic head, this massively imposing figure. Mm-hmm. almost this incredible buildup to who is Snoke. And you're right. Then we come in with Johnson's The Last Jedi, and the first time we see Snoke, he's a much smaller, normal-sized character sitting on a throne. Johnson has no interest in playing along with J.J. Abrams' buildup and J.J. Abrams' sense of mystery.
Yeah, and the same for Rey's parents. That gets seriously undercut.
Well, when you think of all of the hours and hours that were wasted on internet fan theories about who Rey's parents were, and only have it wrapped up in, they were just junkers who sold you off for drinking money. The end.
Yeah. I mean, and even that works, of course, because another one of these themes is sort of a democratization of the whole idea of who's a hero. You know, from the child at the end, all the rest. It's not just about the Skywalkers and this family of aristocrats, you know, deciding the fate of everybody else. And that was cool. Gosh. I mean, yeah, and that, you know, not to get ahead of ourselves, but on my list of characters, I empathize with the point that we were teased about Snoke, and now I feel like I'm never going to get answers about where in the world he came from. Well, and I suppose that, yeah, that's not actually true. I'm sure that someone out there right now is writing an expanded universe novel under contract, but for the movie itself.
Well, and I know there's a whole series of Star Wars comics that are officially licensed by Disney Marvel that may fill in some of these gaps. But I'll go ahead, and because you've opened up the path for me to walk down, dive into my biggest critique of the movie, and it may be more a critique of this new Star Wars trilogy more than it is a critique of this particular film. And my critique would be, we're seeing the playing out of two very different movies between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, and two very different visions for what it is that this trilogy is supposed to be about.
Hmm.
And we've got a little bit of a clash of styles that's actually only going to get worse, because J.J. Abrams is coming back to direct the third movie in the trilogy. So if anything, we're going to get yanked right back to where we were with The Force Awakens.
Right.
But I would say this story, The Last Jedi, part of the reason it really works for me is it cares about the characters. It cares about Luke's failure with Ben Solo and causing Ben Solo to turn into Kylo Ren. The Force Awakens didn't really care about that at all. The Force Awakens was more interested in setting up Kylo Ren as the new Darth Vader. And The Last Jedi is really focused on Luke and what Luke did wrong and how that has affected Luke, whereas I don't get the opinion that The Force Awakens really would have cared that much. And so I think that's a problem for the series overall, because The Last Jedi is a really good film that I think asks some questions, or at least prompts the viewer to ask some questions about who is Snoke. Where did he come from? What's driving him besides a pure lust for power? How did Ben Solo come across Kylo Ren? Because Luke refers to Snoke having already seeded the darkness deep inside Ben Solo before Luke realized what was going on. So somehow those two must have had some kind of contact. What was that contact? How did it proceed? What was the fear and the rage that drove Ben Solo to break bad and go to the dark side? I feel like these are all a lot of questions that the movie raises as you watch it that you kind of want answers to. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought these are the questions that should have been answered by a previous movie in the series. There should have been a previous story that set at least some of this up. And I get the feeling that had Rian Johnson been in charge of the entire trilogy, that The Force Awakens would have been a very different movie that might have focused more on Luke and Ben Solo and Snoke and the Jedi Academy, the Jedi Temple that Luke had tried to set up. I almost feel like The Last Jedi is a movie that comes after whatever movie involves Luke and Ben in the Jedi Temple, that this is a sequel to a movie that was never made. And we've got two different directors with two different visions of what story they want to tell. And this is a very good movie, but it suffers from not having had the first movie in its sequence that should have gone along with it.
Yeah, you know, especially having read comics and a lot, when it comes to serialized storytelling, which, you know, Star Wars movies actually pretend to be, there's often, you know, the writers who come in and kind of fling out stuff in the wall. In fact, another way of putting what you described as J.J. Abrams' style is the Chris Claremont school of writing. That's totally how X-Men was for 10 years. You know, there were always a lot of questions being flung out and very rarely any answers. You know, it was all about the moment. And later you would get these other writers who would come in and you'd always be able to recognize them, the fixers, who take these strings and tie them together into something remarkably cohesive. And you marvel at their brilliance and just taking whatever these other people have thrown out there and making something of it. J.J. Abrams doesn't really do coherent characterization and the like. You know, 1 minute Finn in the first movie is, you know, traumatized and kind of going through this this great moral decision. And the next, he's just geeking out about the fact that he's killing TIE fighters. It doesn't really work if you think about it, but in the moment it's all a lot of fun. Rian Johnson is on another level entirely. I was just thinking to myself, even as I made that complaint about Snoke, that one of the fun aspects of Star Wars, the first trilogy anyway, was that you didn't necessarily learn everything, just what you needed to know. And that I've always loved that about a well-made universe, that it's always clear that a lot more is going on off-screen. It never leaves you in the dark. You get the basics, which The Force Awakens really didn't offer. For example, that the Emperor had just dissolved the Senate. You know, you had a basic idea of what was happening here. A democracy was being taken over by an imperialist monarchy, and then you were free to go. Right. Whereas who the blazes knows where the First Order came from and what their relationship was to the Republic. You can make guesses, but there's never a line.
Right. No, nobody's interested in throwing off the one-off comment that would provide context for what's going on.
Sure. So I don't have any real interest in reading the expanded universe tie-ins to find out more about Snoke and the rest. But I thought this movie did a good job ultimately of telling you what you needed to know and keeping on the movie.
No, I think I agree with you. I'm not necessarily looking to rush out and find the comics that tell the backstory or find the books that tell the backstory. I just think this movie, it had a lot of depth with Kylo's characterization and with Luke's characterization and what the two of them were struggling against. And in some ways, that's the central story of the movie, is each of them dealing with past events. And it's very well done. It's very good, but I feel it would have been better if I had a little bit of a better idea of what it is that Kylo Ren, or what it is, sorry, that Ben Solo went through that turned him dark. Because you feel like there is a story there.
Yeah.
And you feel like you're getting his conflict. And he's got a lot of feelings he's working through towards his uncle and towards his parents. And you feel like we're coming in a little bit on the second half of the story. Of, okay, what is it that he has against his uncle and his parents? What is causing him to react so strongly against them? And you feel there must be something. And this movie works without you knowing what that is. But at the same time, I can't help but feeling it would work a little bit better if we did know.
I would like to see that addressed in the third film. And if that happened, then I would be very satisfied. Because part of what works about the second film See that's the double-edged sword of it, is that it's about wrong footing you. So, you know, if it, so we have to feel like, wait a second. when Snoke gets killed, in order for it to hit hard enough.
Right.
Otherwise it's not telegraphed, but it's still not as big a deal. But no, I would definitely agree that I'd like to see in the third film, an explanation for how it all came about.
And it actually works in this movie, seeing it through Rey's eyes, where she first hears about it from Ben, that mm-hmm. I wake up in bed and a demented Luke Skywalker is standing over me ready to chop my head off. And so I did the only thing I could do. And then much later in the movie, we get Luke's version of events, which is, I briefly thought about it, and then I turned and was reconsidering, but I still had the lightsaber on in my hands, so, oops, that's kind of hard to explain in the middle of the night.
Sure. And it seems like, there's still resolution to be made between those two stories. Kylo Ren, by the way, let's jump into this a little here as far as characters are concerned. Kylo Ren's my favorite character of the new trilogy. I think he's the most interesting one of the whole bunch. And the reason why is not because, it's because instead of framing it as him failing moral tests and falling deeper into the dark side, he is pursuing the dark side and succeeding at successive moral tests. I think that just really kind of flips it a bit and makes it more interesting, that he feels weak. And so he summons up all of his willpower in order to kill his father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then after that, in the second movie, he finds it in himself, if you will, or he comes to realize, and what is an arc of character growth, that he's not going to be Darth Vader.
Yes.
That's not, you know, and that he shouldn't try to be Darth Vader. And he kills his master, of course, as any good Sith should. And he asks Rey to join him. So I just think that's been a really good, that's been a really cool progression to see. You know, he's been building up as a villain. And at the risk of ranting for another minute, I also am hoping for a really crazed First Order under his reign. Because I like the idea of someone who has a lot of power, but not a lot of sense, being a young guy, being in control of this military juggernaut. It would be interesting to see sort of a Trump-level dysfunction.
Mm.
The First Order, instead of turning into the successor to the Republic, you know, the next empire fortifying itself for a long thousand-year reign, to just kind of be simultaneously imploding and more dangerous than ever.
Right. Striking out randomly in all directions. Yeah, and I've got a half page of notes here on Kylo Ren, just because I agree, he's in this movie a much more interesting character than he was in the first movie, at least in my opinion. And I agree, he makes a definite turn. You know, he starts out wanting to be his grandfather, wanting to be Darth Vader, and he's got his own scary-looking mask to go along with that. And I like that Snoke calls him out, and I don't remember the exact wording, but something along the gist of, you're just a scared child with a mask. Take the mask off. You know, you're just play acting. And Kylo realizes that that's true, and not only takes the mask off, but bashes it into pieces, and spends the rest of the movie as his own person, not just an echo of his grandfather. And I like that we get an image of Kylo. He's essentially an impulsive teenager. An impulsive teenager with way too much power. But an impulsive teenager in the way he approaches and reacts to things. And I kept having flashbacks to the prequel trilogy, which I hadn't really intended to delve into, but you get this journey of Anakin Skywalker making a turn to the dark side. And that story was so ineptly told in the prequels that it was a little bit painful to watch. And this seems like what the prequel should have been had they been competently executed. That here we've got a teenager that's got some anger, that's got some fears, that's clearly got some issues with the authority figures in his life. And he's lashing out at them. But hey, he happens to be force-powered, so when he lashes out, holy crap, it gets ugly really fast.
I hadn't thought about that, but yes, Kylo Ren is essentially what Anakin Skywalker should have been in the prequels.
And you can see his family issues with the whole last third of the movie. You know, the Millennium Falcon comes into view, and he reacts with intense anger. Shoot that flying pile of junk out of the sky.
Yes.
And sends every single one of his mobile fighters in pursuit, completely emptying the field of the air support that he should have had. And you're like, that's exactly how a teenager reacts. It's all emotion. It's all in the moment. It's all impulsive. And it leaves him open to making huge mistakes.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. At the risk of moving on to Luke, that perfect needling final sentence from Skywalker, where he says something that Han Solo said to him years ago, "See you around, kid." even with the same, you know, kind of almost a wink, you know, he didn't wink, but you could kind of see it.
It was almost there. Yeah, and Kylo's relationship with Luke is also very interesting, because clearly there it's a relationship that's based on fear, respect, and anger, perhaps in equal measures, that he takes Luke a lot more seriously than he takes anybody else, but at the same time seems to have a grudge that he really wants to prove himself to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why that fight between Luke and Kylo at the end is just absolutely fantastic, because it's so much Luke is toying with him in a "you can't touch me" kind of a sense, which just infuriates Kylo even more.
And literally, as it turns out. Oh, wow. That was, I disagree with my wife on this. She thinks Mark Hamill's a terrible actor. I thought he did great in this. And regardless, but we both agreed that Luke's great showdown with Kylo Ren did have us all pretty much on the edge of our seats, that we just loved it, especially in retrospect.
Yeah, it's a wonderful visual spectacle. You know, going back to what you said before about this movie just looking great, having Luke walk out of that hangar, and then Kylo unleashing the turbo laser barrage from every single AT-AT simultaneously. And not just a few shots, but this sustained barrage that seems to just go on and on and on. And his own officers. And I love it. His officers are clearly afraid of him, but not so afraid of him that they can't needle him. So the general standing on the side angrily asking, "Do you think you got him?" Because, yes, by any sane measure, no one should be walking out of that barrage.
Well, that's the one guy who has the antagonistic relationship with him. I think that was Hux, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And, of course, that sustained barrage is you know, I feel like that speaks volumes of his emotional state. There's just, you know, it's an he would have done that until the turbo lasers ran out of power, if he could have.
Yes.
And again, and my wife said afterwards that, you know, she thought after Luke stepped out of the smoke, "Oh, come on, how is that possible?" and there was a good answer for it. What's so great about the battle is not just, "Oh, Luke played a trick," and that explains how he was invincible, but it's such a Jedi way of going about it.
Yes.
It's pacifist, you know?
It's pacifist in its misdirection and redirection of the highest possible order. And sells it is him walking out of the turbo laser barrage, looking at the AT-ATs with a cocky expression on his face, and just casually brushing off his shoulder. I mean, it's like if you're dealing with a teenager who just tried to destroy you with the full output of 8 AT-ATs, there is no better way to respond than just brush off the shoulder, come and get me.
I also like the fact that, in addition to seeing Leia one last time and all that, he never left his island. I have no strong feelings about him. Is dying the correct word? Him transitioning?
Becoming one with the Force.
Right, at the very end. I'm glad that's how he went. I like that for Luke Skywalker.
I will say that ending ticked me off a little bit.
Yeah?
I
didn't think he had to die. I just kind of, I felt like in a little bit Ivo roll, okay, they're just checking the box on that, but, you know, kill major character. But at the same time, that's how I wanted him to go. And if the same thing had happened in the third film, I would have been, you know, fine with that too.
And I think I would have been fine with it in the third film. I know why he had to go, because you're setting up a new trilogy. Well, we're 2/3 of the way through it now, but you're setting up new characters to carry Star Wars into the future. And you have to have a passing of the baton from the old generation to the new. And that's understandable. What I didn't like is we've got Luke at the beginning. He's on his island. He's been hiding from the world. He's been doing the Jedi Hermit thing because he failed with his pupil, which seems to be kind of a trend with Jedi Masters. Mm-hmm. And he's got a really almost angry perspective on the Jedi. The Jedi failed his father. The Jedi, to a sense, failed him. He failed Kylo. What good is this religion? Yes, I'm on this island with all of these sacred books, but as Yoda appears to basically say, you haven't read them. I know, because page turners, they were not. Luke's here, and he's angry, and he's focused on the past of the Jedi. And he's intending to burn down the tree out of anger, out of just a sense of, let's end all of this so that nobody can ever try to bring it back again. And Yoda shows up, and when Luke falters and almost turns away from burning down the tree, Yoda calls down lightning and burns down the tree. And Yoda essentially says, you're always looking over the horizon. You're not looking at what's here. You need to be, if you're looking anywhere, looking the other direction towards the future of the Jedi Order, which is learn from your mistakes, teach your pupils from your mistakes, build on your mistakes, so that you can help others not to make the same mistakes. And Luke seems to take this into thought, and then we see him show up on the base, facing down Kylo Ren, which to me is a clear indication that Luke has processed this, has accepted it, and is ready to emerge from being a hermit to actually engage with teaching people. And then he dies. And it feels like an unfinished arc at that point. It feels like we need a third movie of him actually beginning to teach Rey and passing along his mistakes, and then merging and becoming one with the Force.
Yeah, it feels like his character arc was complete, but that it didn't lead to him actually going through with it.
Right. And I'm thinking what we're supposed to see is this, the mental exertion of projecting himself over who knows how many star systems away and engaging in this battle of wills with Kylo Ren. To me, it almost looked like we're supposed to conclude that he had a heart attack after the fight was over.
Right.
And he died from the stress, which as an ending, I mean, that works. That's natural. That's okay. I don't feel like that's a cheat. We got to see two movies of Luke in the first trilogy, essentially being a whiny kid, and one movie of him actually acting confident like he knew what was going on. And then we got half a movie of him being a whiny old man.
Which I kind of love. I mean,
which
know,
I kind
personalities
of love.
Don't yeah. change that much in a way.
No, I wrote in my notes, Mark Hamill was just killing it underneath that beard. That was that was Luke. It was Luke old and gray and unkempt, but it was Luke all the way. It was wonderful. And we got like 15-20 minutes of Luke being confident old man Luke, and I just wanted one more movie. Call me selfish. I just wanted one movie of Luke being the absolute kick butt old Jedi master who's actually going to do things the right way. I think that would have been such an awesome movie.
Yeah, I don't suppose. I mean, I guess ultimately what you have to say about it is that it's not what it's what we would dream of happening, but not what they did.
Yes.
You know, and you can't necessarily fault them for that. But I'm glad that we were both pleased with that, because I quite liked it. No, I mean, just those aspects you mentioned. Other characters, and I want to bring this up just in case we run out of time, because this amuses me to no end. Captain Phasma.
Yes.
Her returning, just, you know, with no explanation whatsoever, except whatever was in the tie-in novel. I understand they actually did fill it in. But in order to get punked again, essentially. And then falling to her death. I have in here a section, so I've got in my notes, elements, characters, great moments, problems. And then I have a section called requests. You know, if I can have 5 minutes with Bob Iger or someone, what to say. And what I would say is, at this point, we really must have Captain Phasma appear in the third film. Just because that's the only way that it works now, in my personal opinion. It was weird to just have her pop up again, but you can play that ultimately as sort of a wry joke that this woman is just ridiculously unstoppable.
play it as just a running gag. She shows up even when there's absolutely no reason she should still be alive and still be here.
Yes, exactly. In fact, there's a movie called The Yellow Sea from Korea that played this beautifully. There's a gangster, and a rival gangster sent a couple of gangs, hitmen, to kill him, and he just barely survives. And then it's a problem, because now the rival has the guy coming for him. And then later, you know, he breaks in, and there's an even bigger battle in which the guy is really outnumbered. He just barely pulls it off by the skin of his teeth. And then later, he's finally clearly dead because he's surrounded by 20 guys. But no, 20 minutes later, you see him emerge covered in blood. And you realize you've been punked. that this is just like, this guy is not playing by the same rules as everybody else in the world. So yeah, I think a lot of people are annoyed by how the captain has been treated. But I think at this point, they should just commit.
They should just commit. Well, and Star Wars is the movie series that only keeps a loose grip on reality. And you either love that about the series or you hate the series entirely. But there is so much about Star Wars that if you try to subject it to rational analysis, just breaks down in so many thousands of ways that it's best not to even try. So why not have a character that survives for ridiculous reasons? Because honestly, it's no more ridiculous than Luke mentally projecting himself 50 light years.
And I think, you know, the captain was clearly a sort of Boba Fett figure in the first place. So having her continuously die a Boba Fett-like death seems to me like just a very big wink to fans. You know, I like the idea that if she's the new Boba Fett, that she's doomed to essentially have the same awful thing happen to her, despite the fact that she's supposedly this really powerful warrior.
All you have to do is assume that that cape of hers turns itself into a jetpack at appropriate moments, and I think you've just solved most of her problems right there. And it doesn't have to happen on screen. You can just have that as your headcanon.
Mm. okay, you're next. I chose the last person or topic.
Okay, so I'm going to just throw out a couple of notes, and we can either just throw them out or we can respond to them and talk about them. But some of my notes about just issues I had with the movie. Mm. At the beginning, Poe is demoted from commander to captain, or possibly from captain to commander. I've never understood the rank structure in Star Wars, and obviously Rian Johnson isn't all that interested in having us understand what the rank structure is, because nobody in the movie seems to know what his rank is. So I say the story doesn't seem to care. We probably shouldn't either, but I just throw that out there as one of those small things. It's like, he was demoted, and to me it matters a little bit what his rank was supposed to have been in the movie, and I don't have the faintest clue, because I don't understand what their rank structure is, and the dialogue wasn't clear.
Okay. Yeah, there you have it.
Next thing that bugged me a little bit, and I think you alluded to it before, we don't know where the First Order came from. We're at least 20, if not 30 years removed from the Return of the Jedi. Why does the Rebel Alliance still have only a skeleton force? I don't understand what's been going on out in space for the last 20 to 30 years. They should have, if they've only ever had a skeleton force, they should be gone by now. Otherwise, they should have had more than a skeleton force. And I don't know, it seems like the theme of the first Star Wars trilogy was, here's the Rebels barely hanging on against the Empire.
Sure.
And now the theme of the new Star Wars trilogy is, here's the Rebels barely hanging on against the First Order.
Which is
a little bit lame.
Yeah, let me throw this out there. Like, I actually bothered to look up before this podcast, because I figured that they had filled this in expanding universe materials, and there have, in fact, been some novels published and the like, and I was very disappointed that the headcanon seems to be a lot, or the real canon seems to be a lot dumber than my headcanon, because I thought I had it figured out pretty simple, which is that, you know, the Empire isn't just going to curl up and disappear even after the second Death Star dies. So you've got the galaxy probably split between these two major forces. And so why is Leia running around with some group called the Resistance? Well, probably it's sort of a North and South Vietnam situation, where you've got, you know, you've got the two opposing forces, but then you have the opposing forces, you know, native groups kind of fighting inside enemy territory. And that made sense to me, that she was, you know, she was off the books. You know, they were fighting a proxy war.
And I guess this was played out in The Force Awakens a little bit, because there was some kind of government that they used Starkiller Base to blow up all of the stars and leave just this tiny resistance.
Yeah.
It just comes back to, I feel like I am so not a J.J. Abrams fan. His stuff makes money, and he's got a lot of fans. I'm not one of them. His writing annoys me.
You know what'll take you off is that apparently there was like a scene that kind of explained all that, but due to the first three movies being derided for their long discussions of the political scene, they actually deleted it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That does highly annoy me. I feel like the original Star Wars trilogy had just enough political stuff to give you a firm grounding in what was going on.
It was a great scene.
The prequels ran completely off the rails with politics, but, you know, George Lucas without an editor, what are you going to do?
Right.
And I feel like this new trilogy is suffering from not having enough politics. So, yeah, that just annoys me, because as a kid, reading the Expanded Universe stuff, what I always wanted to see on film was a weak but surviving New Republic who was fighting off the remnants of the Empire that were various people trying to put the Empire back together. And I always felt like that was such good stories, or at least gave you fertile ground to write good stories in. And that's what I always wanted a new trilogy to be, is, okay, the New Republic has a couple of star systems, you know, 2, 10, 20, whatever. And there's an Empire out there that's trying to encroach, and you've got battles going on, and there are so many story opportunities. And instead we just get Rebels on the Run, which it feels like Disney's vision for this current Star Wars trilogy is just to essentially redo the original trilogy for a new generation, and then maybe start telling better stories afterwards. And I've heard some kind of rumors that maybe Rian Johnson will get the opportunity to be the guy for another trilogy once they wrap this one up. And I find myself really hoping that that's true.
Yeah, me too. Definitely on the strength of this film. I think that's official, that he's sort of the showrunner, if you will, or for the next trilogy, which is as good of news as I could hope for.
Yeah. So I think that's, if I was going to boil down, that's my central disappointment, is apparently we're getting the J.J. Abrams trilogy with Rian Johnson moonlighting that essentially just almost reboot Star Wars for a new generation, which, did you need to do that? I don't know. I mean, Disney has a lot of people who are a lot more successful in the film industry than I am, so maybe, but it still feels like a bit of a waste.
I mean, it's obviously the safe play.
Yeah.
You have that much money invested, you don't want to take risks. And yeah, I would agree. It's two J.J. Abrams films with Rian Johnson trying to make things sense and set things up in such a way that that the first film is explained and the third film has more going for it.
And I don't know that we've even heard a title for what the third film in the series is going to be. I just have this sinking feeling that I probably need to prepare myself to be disappointed in it and just to push on and wait until we get whatever the next trilogy is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, obviously, we're committed, so.
You can't not finish it now that we're two movies in.
Yeah, I mean, I was willing to, I don't know, if this one had been as like The Force Awakens, I probably would have dropped the trilogy at this point. But then again, maybe not, because my wife has just been enjoying them. Other notes,
the central flaw of this movie in particular, taking it as a completely unique thing, the main chase sequence with the First Order's dreadnought going after the Resistance's cruiser, I think it was, that didn't work for me. Fortunately, we spent very little time there, which is good, because that was the weakest part of the movie by far. I just wasn't buying the fact that these two groups of ships are pretty much exactly equally matched in speed, and one couldn't draw away from the other, and the other couldn't close the distance, and we just had a long-range bombardment without appreciably weakening the cruiser's shields in any way. Clearly, that whole setup was just meant to provide a launching-off point for Finn and Rose to have their adventures, and for Rey and Luke to do their stuff in the background, and to set up Finn and Rose on the dreadnought. It was a way to just get everybody into position and move them around. But as an actual story element, that didn't work for me.
That's funny. You describe these scenes, and I actually have an alternate feeling about them, which is to say that I feel like Finn and Rose are the people who are kind of given things to do, because there needs to be a mission going on, while these other two static situations are, you know, these other two slow-burning situations are developing. You know, Finn and Rose are the people who need to have an adventure so that we always are excited. And I thought Finn and Rose were actually the weakest part of the movie. I wasn't that intrigued by Casino Planet or even the characters. In fact, I think the problem with Finn is that even though he was a really interesting concept, he quickly became a sidekick in The Force Awakens. And I feel like since then he's just been given stuff to do.
Yeah, he's a character without a firm sense of who he actually is. And that, as you mentioned before, he goes between being traumatized by what happened to him to being the guy who just wants to run away in the escape pod and avoid the battle entirely, to suddenly the guy who's determined to save the day on Casino Planet and on the Dreadnought. And there doesn't seem to be a consistent Finn that you can put your finger on and say, this is who he is. He seems to change depending on what the writer needs him to be doing at a given moment.
Yeah, and an overstuffed film, I mean, because it is a bit snug. You know, there's a lot going on here. There wasn't really time to give him a satisfying character arc. How do you feel about DJ, by the way?
Which one was DJ?
I had to look him up too. No,
that's, is he that's, the cracker dude?
He is the code breaker.
Benicio del Toro.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure he actually got named in the story. I think that may just be what they put in the credits. But yeah, what did you think about Benicio del Toro?
I like the character. It was a bit Han Solo-ish, a bit Lando Calrissian-ish, just a guy
I was about to say, Han Solo is who you think of, not Lando Calrissian, with the whole betrayal and everything in Empire Strikes Back?
Oh, I mean, he's much more Lando than he is Han, but he struck me as Han-ish just from the very beginning of looking out for himself and... you earn the most money by selling to both sides, which Han is a smuggler, seemed to be kind of his attitude towards life. The Empire's not great, but I'm going to run whatever to whoever, no matter how distasteful they may be, because, hey, you got to make a buck to stay alive. But as to the rest, a gambler who's a code breaker, who's got a sense of style, who quickly turns on you and looks out for his own interest. Yeah, this was Lando Calrissian 2.0, to the extent that when they went looking for a code breaker, I half expected them to run into a much, much older Lando Calrissian in the casino. It would not to me have ruined anything to have that be Lando Calrissian that they found. Now, I don't know if that actor... I admit, I don't know if that actor is still with us or not, so I don't know if that even would have been possible.
He's around.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have surprised me, and it would have worked equally well. So no, it was a character I liked and I enjoyed, and I liked him pointing out to Finn and Rose, hey, look, whoever it is that owned this yacht that I stole, sold to both the good guys and the bad guys.
It is nice seeing just that smidgen of moral complexity in this in this universe of good and evil, right?
Oh, yes.
I also think that insofar as how he plays into larger questions, that he kind of is another example of that wrong-footing expectations deal, because whereas Lando Calrissian turned out to have a good heart and just was doing that for his people, he really does seem to just sell him out and go. There's that moment when the AT-ST starts blowing up the stormtroopers, and it turns out BB-8 has hijacked the AT-ST's computer systems. And I had thought that might be Benicio del Toro's character.
I had the same thought.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, there you go then. If we both had the same thought, then it's reasonable to believe that Rian Johnson probably thought we were going to think that.
Because again, it would have tied in with Han suddenly reappearing at the end of Star Wars during the trench run sequence and blowing away the Imperials.
Right. Yeah. So I like that again. Even if he never comes back, I think that kind of worked.
Yes. I will say, I don't remember if I had it written down, but I liked Rose's character. I'm still a little bit cool on Finn because we don't quite know who he is, but I liked Rose. She comes over as all starstruck when she sees Finn down in her section of the ship. You're such a hero. The events that happened on Starkiller Base. Oh my, that was incredible. Wait, why are you standing in front of the escape pod? Uh-huh. Yeah, you're just inspecting the pods, right? I haven't heard that 5 times already today. And then she just casually stuns him. She may be starstruck, but gosh darn it, she's still going to do what she's there to do, and she's not going to let anybody, not even Finn, run off with an escape pod.
Yeah. She's cute. I didn't have strong feelings about her, but I'm fine with her.
Yeah, I'll say she's got a much stronger sense of who she is than Finn does, and that alone is enough to endear her.
I don't think she really had any problems to work through. She's not a character with a story arc.
No.
She's unhappy about her sister, but she doesn't have any unresolved feelings about that. You know, it's just something she's carrying.
Right. So speaking of characters with arcs, what's your feeling on Poe Dameron?
Oh, you know, I really liked that. I loved that, the rogue cowboy turned out to be just in the wrong. That the commanders actually did have a clue what they were doing. It's one of these staples of moviedom that doesn't get analyzed a lot, but to use the classic example, Iceman is a way better pilot than Maverick. I thought that was great.
And his arc, too, just going from at the beginning, he leads the bombing raid that destroys 7/8 of the fighter wing and the bombing wing that they have, wipes out all of the bombers and 7/8 of the fighters, gets demoted for essentially recklessness.
Sure.
And then has to go through at the end. They're doing what, again, wrong-footing the audience. They're doing an attack run on the ground cannon, the battering ram.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just pause and say, I love the ships that they're flying out in. I loved the ships that they're flying out in, that they look 20 or 40 years old. They look like they belong in mothballs, and parts of them are falling off to the extent that Poe's kicking through and having his foot come out the side. That was just, that was wonderful. But they're starting an attack run that you're thinking is kind of like the Hoth battle sequence, where they're going to do their best to loop around, take out the AT-ATs, maybe make some damage on the cannon, something. And then it turns out that they're just getting picked off one by one by one. And Poe has to actually make the decision that, no, we need to order a retreat. This is not working. If we keep doing this, the only outcome is that we're going to get every single one of us destroyed, which is realistic based on the disparity of forces that they were up against. And I don't know if that was too blunt for him as a character arc, if that was too on the nose as a patent reversal of how the movie opened. But at the same time, it did show growth in leadership, that he was willing to order a retreat and to, okay, let's find a different way to do this other than just a full out frontal assault.
Yeah, no, I have no complaints really. I thought they pulled off that arc perfectly. The tragedy, which doesn't affect the character because Force B praised he will never learn about it, but if you think about it, he's responsible for losing 9/10 of the remaining rebels on the way down to the salt planet.
Mm.
Because otherwise Finn and Rose would not have boarded the vessel, been caught, and then the Codebreaker would not have told the First Order what was happening.
Right.
But he's not gonna understand that he has those deaths on his head, so that's not going to completely cripple the character. And probably half the audience probably will never make the connection. So that
I myself hadn't made the connection until you mentioned it, and it now seems deadly obvious in retrospect. But there you go. It's easy to miss the obvious when it's right in front of you.
Well, I mean, it's a big movie. There's a lot going on.
Oh, there is.
Fridge logic, you know. The Porgs. I liked them.
So the Porgs, I think, were problematic. They were cute. I don't know what to do with the fact that Chewie had killed, skinned, and roasted one of them. And then we have them as cute, adorable characters in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. I really don't know what to do with that at all. Are we supposed to just accept that Chewie didn't eat any more of them because they were just too darn cute? Are they supposed to be some level of sentient beings, or are they just really, really cute animals that he couldn't bear to eat after they gave him the eyes?
My headcanon here is that meal was prepared for him by the natives. But there's no signal one way or the other from the movie, but that was how I explained it in my head. I didn't consider it a sticking point, you know, or if it was a really minor one, in which case I just come up with a solution of my own, and that was mine.
I think I'd have to go with your headcanon there. I mean, Wookiees are supposed to be hunters. It's in the expanded universe stuff that's pretty much hammered on over and over and over, so it's totally believable that Chewie would have captured his own Porg, but it makes more sense if I think about it as the natives prepared him the Porg. He's set to, or at least captured and killed the Porg for him, and he's cooking it over the fire, and then happens to see them as they really are, and they're so cute that he just can't bear to eat them. That works better as headcanon than believing that he hunted, killed them, was about to eat them, and then decided that they were much too cute.
Yeah. Oh, your mileage may vary as far as, but what I liked about the Porgs is, you know, they're quick laughs.
Yes.
They're cute. They're funny. They aren't aggressive like Jar Jar Binks or the Ewoks are. You know, they don't take up a significant portion of the film. And I feel like if they're really bothering you, then you're just kind of have a bit of a problem yourself, because you know it's not much time.
Yeah, from that angle, I will agree with you wholeheartedly. They don't try to take over the movie and overdose you on the cuteness. They're just there in a few scenes, and it's fine.
Porgs, Lix goes, the Force. How do you feel about the Force in this movie?
Well, it was a heck of a lot better than midichlorians. I had a moment there where I was petrified Luke was going to bust out speaking about midichlorians, and I think I would have lost it. What is the Force? Well, there's these things swimming around in your blood.
He pulls out a blackboard. Stay with me.
I've got my genetic tester. It's in the other trunk. Let me just go and get it, and we'll talk about no. It being the vitality of life, the continual cycle of life and death and rebirth and energy and violence and all of that, that worked for me. If you're going to have to describe to somebody what the Force is, I think that's about as good of an explanation as you're ever going to get.
Yeah, okay. I do too. And I would also say that I liked the new Force powers that we're seeing, new things that it's capable of. It feels interesting to me a little more again.
Right.
Briefly, this is just where my writer's brain goes. You know, there's no way that this would ever have happened, and was foolish to think it in the first place. But I kind of liked the idea of Luke's decision that the Jedi Order just needed to die. Because as Snoke himself points out, you know, whenever one of these really powerful characters learns the ways of the Force, you know, the Force is balance. And so consequently, you know, you have this struggle develop. And I thought that maybe Luke's big idea was that he could just end the cycle.
Mm. I thought Luke was, I mean, one, maybe he was trying to get rid of Force users entirely because of feeling that it always ends up out of control. Alternately, I thought maybe he was going more towards a democratization of the Force, the way he makes a point of saying it's not my Force. Mm. It's not my thing that I have control on. It's just out there. And it almost seemed like he was on the verge of saying it's something that anyone can do if you're just aware enough and open enough to it. You can reach out and influence things, and most people are too closed off, but it is a thing that conceptually maybe anyone could do. And he didn't go that far, but that seemed to be the angle the story wanted to lean into.
Even that would have been interesting to me. I liked the idea of a post-Jedi understanding of the Force, or, you know, or a new direction.
Well, and it ties back to the conversation you and I had about Rogue One, about the two, or the one, really, Force-using character in Rogue One who wasn't a Jedi, but was using the Force to affect how he was moving through the world and perceiving things and doing things. And I remember talking at the time about, it's interesting that we've got a character who's not a Jedi, but is a Force user. And we seem to be leaning in that direction of it's time for the Jedi to end, because it's a religion based around the Force, but you don't necessarily need the religion and the structure. You can just have people who are using the Force.
Yes. No, I 100% agree. I think that would be fascinating, but it's, you know, the Jedi being such a mainstay of Star Wars, it's probably unlikely.
It's probably unlikely, but at the same time, you can make an argument that based on the prequels, that the Jedi as an order that trains people how to use this power really is a failed organization. Mm-hmm. They've got serious problems. As Luke said, to you, the Jedi are myth and heroes, but it was really just a bunch of bureaucracy and infighting and squabbling and making really stupid decisions. So, no, it's time for the Jedi to end. That isn't a structure we need to emulate and to recreate. And speaking of failed structures, can we just for a minute talk about the Sith? And the apparently hereditary stupidity of Sith Lords, because Sith Lords are forever being killed by their apprentices in ways that seems like just a fault of hubris and arrogance. And I guess hubris and arrogance is part of what makes you a Sith Lord in the first place. So maybe it's a fatal flaw in the entire order of the Sith. Mm-hmm. But we've got one Sith Lord after another. And this is semi-canon in the expanded universe stuff, that going back to the entire history of the Sith, it's one Sith Lord after another being killed by his apprentice, eventually turning on him and wiping him out. And that's we get it with Darth Vader tossing the Emperor down the shaft in the Death Star. And then we get essentially the exact same thing with Kylo Ren deciding to take out Snoke. And that scene was wonderfully done, where the lightsaber is sitting on the side of the throne, exactly like it was in The Return of the Jedi. And Snoke is talking about how my apprentice is going to complete his training and strike you down. And yes, he's turning the lightsaber. He's activating it to kill his greatest enemy. And at that point, the lightsaber cuts through Snoke, which is just wonderful. Going through for the straight cut the body in half was just it was great visuals. But at a certain point, you feel like Snoke should be self-aware enough to think, I should be at least a little bit on my guard that he's not thinking of me as his greatest enemy, because that's like the entire tradition of the Sith.
I thought what was so clever about, it's really clever how they did an end run around his telepathy and his omniscience. You know, he should have seen it coming, and I thought they provided a really good explanation for why he didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the Sith's legacy, yeah, I mean, outright stating it, it does seem like one of those "why don't they do this" sort of things. I chalk it up to it being an inherent error. Mm. You know, that The problem with the dark side is that everyone thinks they can be smarter and not be overpowered by it. But once that you're in the dark side, then it essentially creates the conditions that eventually leads to each Sith Lord's defeat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they implode because they have usually, it's not that this is a formal structure, you know, they have one person, but usually that's about how long they last, long enough to train someone else before that person goes crazy and kills them. You know, so it's, I don't see it so much as a formal structure and, or something that's a law of the universe so much as just, you know, an inherent problem with anger and hate being driving force.
Well, and like I say, I think hubris and arrogance. I mean, it totally works with my own headcanon to say that part of being Sith is to be arrogant enough to think that you're not going to make the mistakes that your own master made, because of course he was an idiot,
right?
Whereas you are smarter and better and can handle it, right up until the moment that your own apprentice cuts you in half, because you were too arrogant to consider the possibility that he might do so.
Totally. I enjoyed that very much for all of the reasons that you've stated.
I almost like the thought that part of the mark of having achieved full Sith masterhood, full Sith lordship, is that you train your pupil to the point where they kill you. That's like you've passed the final test of having been a Sith Lord, is that you have successfully incited your pupil to knock you off and to assume your position.
Sure, yeah, and you know, even Sith Lords may even be kind of cognizant of that. You know, I could see, you know, the Emperor expecting to have to whack Darth Maul.
Right.
And oh, he got killed by Qui-Gon Jinn before that happened, so I'll start getting this guy. But, you know, okay, he's eventually going to try to betray me, and I'm going to kill him first.
Right.
I could see that. And Snoke just not seeing it coming.
Yeah.
It works for me. What else you got?
So last point I had to talk about was Princess Leia herself.
Yeah.
And I wasn't intending to end here, but I'll take it if this is where we end up ending the podcast. I don't know how much of this film was shot and plotted before Carrie Fisher's death versus after Carrie Fisher's death. I will say that there were multiple times in the film where I expected Princess Leia to die because I knew that Carrie Fisher had died, and I had, and maybe it was a wrong feeling, but I had thought that she had died before they'd fully finished photography, and that therefore there would come a point in the script where they would end up just writing her out. She would die in the story, and we'd have a little bit of a eulogy and a passing of Princess Leia, and it would, for the audience, be a passing of Carrie Fisher. And so I felt like, deliberately or not, Rian Johnson was wrong-footing us multiple times through the movie, where I expected Princess Leia to die, and she didn't, and I was pleasantly surprised that she kept hanging around and kept influencing events.
You're right. I mean, I think he intended to wrong-foot us, but Carrie Fisher's death actually heightened that expectation. You're right, there were multiple points where I thought, oh, okay, they're just going to edit her out, right. You know, here at the rest, because this is a perfect time to just say goodnight. I agree.
It does make me wonder if we're going to do anything with Princess Leia in the third movie, or if she's just going to die an off-screen death before the third movie even starts.
I would bet heavily on the latter, myself. In fact, I think they may have said as much. You know what you would have lost if they had written her out at any of those moments, though, is her goodbye to Luke.
Yes.
I mean, that was a good scene.
That was a very good scene. And knowing that it was the last scene that Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher will ever do together, in some ways maybe made it even a better scene.
That's the thing about this movie, and why I honestly had to think about it for a while before I decided I liked it. There's just so much meta involved for me in a Star Wars film now. You know, it's hard for me to get engaged in the story sometimes, because I'm just considering so many other, you know, aspects of it. I'm usually pretty decent about shutting off my brain and getting surprised by things that other people think, oh, you didn't see that coming? But with Star Wars, especially after The Force Awakens, you know, that's tougher for me.
Right.
Okay, so I mentioned earlier that I had requests.
Yes.
To Disney for the last movie. One of them was that Captain Phasma would come back without any explanation whatsoever and try to kill Finn again. and this is just me putting on my hat real quick, but I think it would be interesting if the third movie ended not with the First Order being overthrown, but simply with the First Order's leadership being decapitated, which is to say that it seems to me like they've got pretty firm control over things, and the stormtroopers are here to stay. The only question is who's directing them. So if they could somehow work it out to where the saga ends with the First Order in charge, but the First Order being a force for good, or at least under new management, that would be a decent resolution without being entirely expected.
I'll take that, and I'll go in a slightly different direction. I feel like a First Order under the control of Supreme Leader Snoke ends the resistance on whatever the heavily armored planet was. Because mainly they escape because Kylo is able to be baited into focusing all of his attention on Luke while everybody else slips out the back door. And I don't think Snoke makes that mistake. And the resistance is basically, at this point, down to whoever fits in the Millennium Falcon is what it really looks like. So we're talking a very, very small force. Now, I think Kylo Ren, and I had this in my notes, actually, that Darth Vader was the epitome of icy control. Darth Vader knew what was going on and executed ruthlessly and was terrifying because of that.
Right.
And as we saw through the prequels, that was something he had to grow into. Anakin Skywalker was not icily controlled. Anakin Skywalker was angry and impetuous. Kylo Ren is at the angry, impetuous stage of his life, but he no longer has a Sith mentor to guide him through Angry Impetuous to Icy Impetuous. So what I would like to see out of the third movie is not that First Order leadership gets decapitated, but that Kylo Ren is easily distracted, lashing out, not paying attention to the details. And because of that, the Resistance is able to grow and thrive and carve out a space of control that is free of the First Order and relatively safe. And that we, in this trilogy, I want to see more of Kylo Ren, honestly. I don't want to see him die at the end of the next movie. I want to see him still struggling with impulse control and having to face the fact that the First Order is less than it had been because of his leadership, and that we see the Resistance is thriving or even turning into a nascent New Republic because of the space that Kylo Ren's impetuousness has opened up.
I feel like that's... Oh, well, I don't know. Never underestimate the executive who's looking at feedback, because Kylo Ren's clearly a popular character. But it seems to me that the third part of the trilogy is primed indecisively.
Yes.
And I would hope it would end decisively. I mean, the second movie here is a great place to have things, you know, so many questions left, but... yeah, I'd be very surprised if things ended with essentially a sort of stalemate between a new burgeoning republic and the First Order.
And this is why this would be filed under a request rather than an expectation, because I would like to see a second trilogy
that is enough. The
New Republic stepping out and working on pushing back the First Order and expanding the zone of freedom and liberty and what have you. I think that would make an awesome next trilogy, but I doubt that Disney agrees with
it. The Star Wars war films. Part of the reason that I don't want to see that is because I am this. I mean, this one of the great successes of this film is that it did manage to get me to have some geeky feels again for Star Wars. But honestly, the thought of another trilogy in which people are shooting stormtroopers and trying to stop super weapons just doesn't enthuse me at all. And of course, and that's what would happen in that case. You know, it would be missions against First Order bases and so on and so forth. And I don't know, this movie stoked my interest in seeing one more, but another trilogy.
Well, here's the thing. There's going to be another trilogy, and I was thinking about how you would do a new trilogy, but I keep coming back to the name of the series is Star Wars. I don't know how you get away from that when that's kind of the whole foundation of your trilogy or of your series.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we will see.
So what else you got?
I think that's actually about it for me. Looking through all my notes, talked about all. As far as great moments are concerned, that moment when Leia's second in command rams the cruiser into Snoke's ship at light speed.
Speaking of your great, beautiful visuals, oh my, that was beautiful.
Yes, it was. And during that long space of quiet, when you're watching the ship separate, all that debris fly. Apparently this happened in a number of theaters, but one kid somewhere said, "Holy smokes." And everyone laughed. Little bastard. it was hilarious. If he kept talking after that and thought he was funny, that was a great moment. And it really was impressive. Ryan Johnson and what his cinematographers are just fabulous.
Yes.
But that's about all I have. So, good.
It was a good movie. I mean, if I'm going to sum this up, it was a good movie. It made me really, really want to see Rian Johnson's vision for Star Wars. I don't think it was a perfect movie, but I think most of its imperfections stem from being the middle movie in someone else's trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
But this does make me very much look forward to whatever it is that he does next in the Star Wars universe, or even, and I've always known, or I've already known, I've liked him as a director and a writer, but if he does more stuff outside of the Star Wars universe, I'm definitely interested in seeing that as well.
I was just thinking as I was talking about how I wasn't interested in seeing another trilogy of films about fighting the Empire or some substitute for the Empire, that, okay, but they'll be done by Rian Johnson.
Right.
Yeah, and that does hold a lot of sway with me. So, yeah, on the strength of this, maybe, you know, an unending series of Star Wars movies isn't that bad an idea after all.
And on that note, we'll go ahead and end tonight's conversation. Thank you, Adam.
Hey, it was good talking to you again, Joe.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well, @AdamVolle. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.
And we're here to, after having just seen Star Wars The Force... Oh my god.